Hi, this is Sedge Thompson. Welcome to this special audio highlights podcast from West Coast Live. For more information about our shows and other guests and podcasts, wcl.org. My next guest on West Coast Live has been on before, but it was in connection with the Grateful Dead, as I recall. He's also won a gold record for helping co-produce a box set of Grateful Dead music, but he also writes regularly for Wired magazine and other publications. I've been reading his work for years. We used to be neighbors in the Haight-Ashbury. I'd see him on the street. He was always busy working on projects. What were you working for at the time?
Probably Wired.
Probably Wired at that time. Anyway, he has written a fascinating new book called Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. And he's blessed to have a foreword by the late, great Oliver Sacks. And I've found this a wonderful explanation of the story. And we're here to talk to them. But please welcome Steve Silberman to West Coast. How do you do?
Nice.
So nice to see you again.
Yeah. Have a seat. Have a chair. I'm interested in the title, but first of all, I mean, I'd like to know a little bit about what has been the traditional definition of autism. I've often, I've known children, young adults who have been described as autistic, and understood, seen where they are. For instance, one fellow I knew, he had a phenomenal memory. I gave him a directory of broadcasting stations in the United States, probably thousands of them. He memorized the entire book. You could name him a call letter. He'd give you the city. He'd give you the frequency. He'd give you the wattage of the tower. I mean, he knew all this. Impossible to deal with in many other respects. Then there are phrases now that I hear people saying, oh, he or she is a little aspie, short for Asperger's. And so it's described as a spectrum. First of all, could you define for us what is meant by autism?
Sure. The definition of autism has changed radically in the past 30 years or so, and that's really kind of the story of my book. It didn't used to be considered a spectrum. It used to be considered a very narrowly defined condition. It was really only seen as a childhood disorder. Most of the children who were diagnosed with it could not speak. But that has obviously, that definition has obviously been broadened radically in the last 30 years. So now you have people who could even work at billion-dollar Silicon Valley companies who can honestly say that they're on the autism spectrum. But there didn't used to be a spectrum, and that's really the story of my book.
In this spectrum of what would be sort of the mild end of it? I mean, the severe end would be unable to make eye contact, unable to speak. Clearly there's a person in there, but for whatever reason is interpreting the world in a different way. What is, as you call it, the neurodiversity of sort of the milder end?
Well, here's the thing. I actually don't like to envision the spectrum as running from mild to severe, and more importantly, neither did a cognitive psychiatrist named Lorna Wing, who first really discovered the spectrum in England, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But because if you say the mild end of the spectrum, I think that tends to underestimate the difficulties in social situations that people who are on the spectrum have. And if you say the severe end of the spectrum, then you tend to underestimate the abilities that those people have, even if they need a keyboard to talk. So I'm not making light of the fact that some people with autism are obviously much more profoundly impaired than other people. However, I think that thinking in terms of mild or severe or high functioning or low functioning, that in a sense, both extremes are lies. Because so-called higher functioning people tend to have more challenges than are apparent to the casual observer.
For instance?
Well, for instance, a lot of autistic people who are considered or branded high functioning tell me that if they spend time in a social situation, that it takes a tremendous amount out of them. That they basically, one of the sort of essential characteristics of autism is that autistic people have a hard time making sense of the little social signals that we all send to each other to broadcast how we're feeling. For instance, as you and I are sitting here now, I'm looking in your eyes, I'm saying, oh, looks like he's interested in that. Or I'll say something and Perhaps you'll smile and I'll say, oh, that's good. You know, maybe I better talk more about that. Autistic people have a really hard time doing that, particularly if they're also listening to your voice. They might have a hard time processing body language or your tone of voice or your facial expressions while they're trying to make sense of what you're saying. So autistic people tend to be very uncomfortable in social situations, and that even goes for people who are at the so-called mild end of the spectrum.
What is the meaning of autism? Where does the word come from?
It comes from the Greek word for self, autos, or something like that, because I don't know how to pronounce Greek. But originally, autistic people were considered sort of shut inside themselves. And actually, one of the things that we've learned after 70 years of research is that even if, say, an autistic person is standing off to the side and looking away, that they might be actually very intently listening to what you're saying. That's actually one of the misperceptions that psychiatrists had for a long time. They would say, well, autistic people don't look you in the eye because they're trying to shut you out. That's totally wrong. They're usually having trouble processing your facial expressions at the same time that they're listening to your voice. And one of the people who discovered autism, in fact, I would go so far as to say the true discoverer of the autism spectrum, a Viennese pediatrician named Hans Asperger, noticed in his typically insightful and prescient way that the children in his clinic who appeared to be sort of looking down or not making eye contact or whatever actually were learning a tremendous amount about the world while they were doing that.
One of the more horrifying stories that you tell in here is the story of how the Nazis treated disabled children and actually had a plan they developed to murder these children who were perceived to be disabled, so much so that mothers began to fear the vehicle that would come along to collect him, calling it the murder box.
Yes, that's exactly true. The story of Hans Asperger is a very dark and very complicated one. He was a pediatrician working at the University of Vienna in a clinic called the Children's Clinic. And what they did there was something that they called therapeutic education. It was an incredibly progressive place for its time. They would have the children do dancing classes to music. Asperger would read poetry to the children. Most of the children there were sort of rejected by society. They'd been sent there by schools that had expelled them. Many of them had been expelled from multiple schools. Or they'd be sent there by the juvenile courts. So it was sort of a clinic of last resort, in a sense. But the staff there was extremely insightful about working with children with special needs. Now we would say it was special education, but even more than that, the people who worked at the clinic actually lived with the children. And the reason why they were able to come up with a very, very prescient view of autism was that they basically observed them in the course of their daily lives, not just for some kind of like 2-hour clinical evaluation or test. And one of the things that they figured out, one of the things I uncovered for the book was the very first case history of an autistic person that was written in Asperger's clinic and published in the mid-1930s, so long before autism was officially discovered, was that they noticed that the intelligence tests that they used to test the children did not work on autistic children. That the tests were not suitable, and instead of deciding that the children were feeble-minded, as was the term in use at the time, they decided that their intelligence tests were broken and that they had to come up with a different way of testing intelligence in autistic children. And that was one of their very valuable and very prescient insights, and that's something that we're even just coming to now.
What was Asperger's fate?
Well, Asperger, he was sent to the front, in the Austrian army once. Well, I mean, the important thing to mention is that all of that progressive stuff came under threat in 1938 when the Nazis marched into Austria to annex it for the German fatherland. They passed a bunch of eugenics laws. And one of the things that I talk about in the book that is, I must say, hard for some mothers to read, I've heard, is that the Germans initiated a secret extermination program against disabled children and adults. And that was actually the practice run for the Holocaust. The Germans actually figured out how to kill people en masse, move their bodies around, etc., by practicing on disabled children, including the kinds of children who were in Asperger's clinic. And so Asperger did everything that he could to protect the children in his clinic. And in fact, one of the historical ironies that I uncover in my book is that it's long been believed that Asperger saw only quote-unquote high-functioning children, the children that he compared to absent-minded professors. Actually, he only told the Nazis in the very first public talk on autism in 1938 about his quote-unquote most promising cases. And people have not really known why he did that, because they didn't look at Asperger's work in the context of what was going on with eugenics in Austria at the time, but he was telling them about his most promising cases so that the children in his clinic would not be killed.
What was your way into this story? What interested you first?
Well, yes, I had a very unusual introduction to the topic, I must say. Most autism books are either written by parents or clinicians or autistic people themselves. My doorway into it was I was on a boat in Alaska writing an article for Wired magazine in the year 2000. And on the boat with me were more than 100 computer programmers. And it was called a Geek Cruise. And it was an entrepreneur's effort to basically host tech conferences in places more interesting than the Pittsburgh Civic Center or something like that. So we were, you know, cruising up towards the Arctic Circle, and it was amazing. And there were all these programmers, and they were fascinatingly eccentric and brilliant, and it was cool. And there was sort of a star of the cruise named Larry Wall, who invented a programming language called Perl, which became, as Perl hackers like to say, the duct tape of the internet. It was one of the things that really made the modern digital world possible. And so before the boat got back into port in Vancouver, I asked Larry if I could interview him at home in Silicon Valley. And he said, yeah, sure, I should tell you, we have an autistic daughter. And at that point, like most people who did not have a personal connection to autism, almost everything I knew about autism was from the movie Rain Man, which really showed people all over the world for the first time what an autistic adult was like. Even people who had been in the autism community for 20 years had not seen an autistic adult when Dustin Hoffman appeared on the screen all over the world. So it was really a much more groundbreaking and revolutionary movie than it got credit for. Like, people now look at it as, oh, he was such a cliche, he was such a stereotype. Actually, there was no stereotype of autistic adults back then. So it was a really revolutionary movie. Anyway, but I didn't know much more than that. So when Larry said that, I thought, oh, that's interesting. So I went to his house. His daughter wasn't there. I did notice that Larry had sort of customized the environment of his house in ways that were appropriate for someone with highly acute senses. For instance, he had swapped out the buzzer on his clothes dryer for a little light bulb that would silently light up when the cycle was over. So I thought, oh, that's interesting, but I didn't connect it to autism yet because I didn't know that much about it. Anyway, so I wrote the article about the Geek Cruise. A few months later, I was profiling another technologically very adept family in Silicon Valley. The patriarch of the family had built the first computer in the Middle East, actually. And so I asked the sister-in-law of the woman I was profiling if I could come visit her at home. And she said, yeah, sure. By the way, we have an autistic daughter. And I thought, God, that's a funny coincidence, especially because autism at that point was still considered extremely rare. And so I was telling a friend of mine at the Reverie Cafe up in Coal Valley, where I live, about this odd coincidence. And a woman sitting at the next table said, oh, my God, do you realize what's going on? And I said, what's going on? She said, I'm a special education teacher in Silicon Valley. There's an epidemic of autism in Silicon Valley. Something terrible is happening to our children. And so I got the chills. You know, it was like one of those turning point moments in my life, you know. Because I was a science reporter for Wired, I thought, I got to figure out if this is really true. And so I wrote an article for Wired called The Geek Syndrome that sort of made kind of a big splash. But what surprised me about it was that I got email about it for years and years and years. And anybody who's a magazine writer knows that magazine articles are like snowflakes usually. You know, like people might notice them at first, but then they sort of melt away and nobody remembers them. Anyway, for 10 years, I would get email from families, from autistic people, from clinicians. And what I noticed was that they were talking mostly about how when children would so-called age out of the services that are provided to autistic children, there was nothing for them. The families were left out in the cold. There were no supports and no resources. And hardly anyone was talking about this in the media. What were they talking about? They were having a loud argument about vaccines. Do vaccines cause autism? Because a now discredited doctor in England named Andrew Wakefield had proposed that there was a link between the MMR vaccine and autism. That basically dominated the entire practically global public conversation.
And it scared people enough to stop getting vaccines. Exactly. No connection was ever shown.
Exactly.
But it deflected people from really the other issues that you're now talking about. One of the points you make in the book is that people began recognizing symptoms in a different way and began sort of in a way accepting them and speaking aloud about them.
Well, here's the thing. One of the things that was happening at the same time that the world was having this argument about vaccines was that autistic people who were capable of using keyboards to communicate were building communities online, sort of in the little niches of the internet, and they were coming together. And when this first started happening, the diagnosis wasn't even really available to adults. So, like, if you read those really early conversations on the very early internet between autistic people, one of the things that they're saying is, I was diagnosed with autism when I was a child. I still feel pretty odd. Like, does that, you know, this syndrome last into adulthood? Because the diagnosis was not available to adults really until the late 80s and early 90s here. And so in England, they were a little ahead of us. They knew that autistic children grew up into autistic adults, but here, not so much. And still, there's so much focus on children rather than adults. And actually, one of the worst things about the vaccine argument was that it tended to make previous generations of autistic people invisible. For instance, Jenny McCarthy, one of the most prominent spokespeople for the anti-vaccine movement, once said, there were no autistic adults in the past. It's all now. And the truth of the matter is, there were. They were, like Dustin Hoffman and Rain Man, often institutionalized, often hidden behind other labels. Then they had been diagnosed not with autism when they were kids, but with something called childhood schizophrenia, which we now understand is extremely rare. But in the 50s and 60s, there was a quote-unquote epidemic of childhood schizophrenia in places like Langley Porter Psychiatric Institute, two blocks above my house in Coal Valley. There were hundreds of children who would now be described as having autism, but they had been diagnosed with childhood schizophrenia. So one of the things I did was to look for the lost autistic people in previous generations.
Well, one of the people you talk about is a man named Henry Cavendish, lived in Clapham Common in London. Aristocratic man, wealthy. He always went on the walk in exactly the same streets with the same posture, and he was the one who would subsist only on leg of mutton.
That's true. Yeah, he actually was a scientist before the word scientist was invented. In the last years of the 18th century, he made many, many major discoveries in many important fields of science. He was the first person to discover hydrogen. He discovered the composition of water. He studied the mathematics of musical intervals. He was, you know, an incredibly prolific scientist. But he was also very socially awkward. He had an almost impossible time talking to people face to face. He would, for instance, communicate with the servants in his household by leaving notes on a table. He wore the same outfit every single day. When it would wear out after years, he would instruct his tailor to create the identical outfit. He ate leg of mutton at virtually every meal. He took the same walk every night. Basically, if he hadn't been lucky enough to be born into a wealthy family, he would have ended up in Bedlam, the psychiatric hospital in London. The only reason why he was able to make these discoveries in science was that his father had provided for him with this estate.
So, the other part of the story, when you take a look at not only history but other people who sort of talk about their own experiences with this, is that there is a political lobbying struggle that's gone on between institutions that work with people who are impaired and the independent autistic people themselves over ad campaigns, over how they're perceived. In some ways, it read as if it was the way how gay rights developed in some ways, and how people were perceived as outsiders in one way, but in other ways, needed to be accepted and recognized for who they are. It was about acceptance of who people are of themselves.
That's true. It's an imperfect analogy, I'll say, because there's nothing about being gay that is in itself a disability, whereas autism is definitely a quite serious and pervasive disability. However, as a gay man myself, now married, it was not lost on me that my condition was described as a mental illness in the DSM, the so-called Bible of Psychiatry, until 1974. And what got it out of there was not that science made a discovery that actually homosexuals are not, in fact, psychotic, but it was political organizing and marching in the streets that delisted homosexuality as a mental illness. Now, here's the thing. Autism is inherently itself a disability, but there are many different ways that society can support and accept it. So, as I say, it's not a perfect analogy, but I would say that the first new civil rights movement of the 21st century is really evolving among autistic people and people with other cognitive disabilities, because they're realizing that by saying, well, we don't have to worry about autistic people and civil rights because someday we'll cure it, and so we'll just throw another $1 billion at finding the causes of autism.
But what you're saying is that it's neurodiversity. It's part of ancient human DNA, that these different ways that people's brains are wired does show up, and it leads to creativity, it leads to science, it leads to a curious kind of focus that has wonderful attributes for humanity.
That's true. The short description of neurodiversity is great minds don't necessarily think alike. And in fact, one of the things that happens to people when they read my book is that they think back to people that they grew up with and they think, oh yeah, that guy Michael in my class who hardly ever talked to anybody, he was probably on the spectrum. But there was no spectrum. And once you learn what autistic people are like, either by reading about them or actually hanging out with them, I have a lot of autistic friends now, you realize that there were people in your past or perhaps in your family tree that you didn't know were autistic or who didn't know themselves that they were autistic, but they were.
It's an incredible story, not the least of which is the story of our own sort of human packaging of our own differences and how we reframe them. It's called Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity by Steve Silberman. Thanks very much for coming to talk with us.
Thank you so much.
Steve Silberman, here on West Coast. Good to see you. This is Edge Thompson. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Try out others from West Coast Live right here, and we look forward to having you in one of our audiences one day. For more information, wcl.org.